Teddy already missed.
You're gonna make me lonesome when you go.
I want every delegate at this convention to understand that as long as I'm a vote, and as long as I have a voice in the United States Senate,
you're gonna make me lonesome when you go.
The Democrats have a little problem now that Teddy Kennedy is gone.
It's going to be for that Democratic platform plank that provides decent quality of health care.
Wonder what I'm doing, staying far behind without you. You're gonna make me wonder what I'm saying. You're gonna make me give myself a good talking to.
Democrats are giving themselves a good talking to about where to go next in the healthcare debate. Substance, symbolism, and good old Washington gridlock.
You're gonna make me lonesome when you go.
Don't worry, I'm not going anywhere. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Not going anywhere, that's right. Good morning, it's Thursday, August 27th, 2009. I'm John Huckenberry here with Femi Okeh. Good morning,
I
Femi.
I like that Dylan Kennedy mix. Good morning, everybody.
From Blood on the Tracks.
Coming in, coming up this morning, we will be looking at Republicans who are mourning the death of the Lion of the Senate. We'll be tracking the economy with the latest GDP number. And is work stress making you sick? Me, maybe. May have the antidote, John.
Oh, but first, John Costin up in Kennebunk, Maine. There's plenty of appropriate substance and symbolism with the passing of Teddy Kennedy. But whether the senator is in the picture or not, as a small business owner, you still have the same health care concerns in your small business, right?
Yeah, even without Senator Kennedy, we still cannot afford to provide health insurance either for our employees or even for myself, John.
Is a progressive solution the one that will save the day, the sort of Kennedy solution, or is it more of a free market solution in your view?
Absolutely a progressive solution, a public option. The free market and private insurers have failed to control health care costs, and we simply cannot afford that kind of plan.
Well, we'll see how the Kennedy passing will affect the debate in health care. Stay with us, John. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, Senator Ted Kennedy's family gathers in Cape Cod today for a private ceremony. A motorcade will then take his body to Boston, where he'll lie in repose. Talk of how to fill his Senate seat is happening already in Massachusetts. Democratic Governor Deval Patrick now supports Kennedy's recent request to change state law. Kennedy wanted a successor appointed immediately.
Other quick headlines. The CDC and a White House panel don't agree on that alarming 90,000 dead number that the White House released this week. The CDC disagrees with the presidential panel. Overseas, a U.S. service member is dead after an attack in southern Afghanistan. August is now tied with July as the deadliest month for American troops there. Two big economic reports out this hour, the latest figures for GDP and the weekly jobless claim numbers. We'll report on them when they come out in about a half hour from now. Wall Street was flat yesterday. The futures suggest another flat opening. The Dow opens today at 95.44, the S&P 1028, and NASDAQ starts trading at 20.24. All week long, we've been getting stories of young people making the decision to get insurance or not. Is the cost too high? What are the considerations? The stories have been great. Keep them coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Huckenberry with Femi Okeh.
Good morning.
There's a plot line, I think, as we think about the passing of Teddy Kennedy.
What's the plot?
The plot in Washington, I think, is emotional symbolism meets political substance.
Yes.
With the idea is whether actual Washington gridlock can be removed.
Is that the conclusion?
That's not the conclusion. Maybe it's the hope of some. But here's President Obama speaking yesterday from his vacation spot in Martha's Vineyard.
Over the past several years, I've had the honor to call Teddy a colleague, a counselor, and a friend. And even though we have known this day was coming for some time now, we awaited it with no small amount of dread.
It's probably fair to say there are some Democrats in the House and Senate who are dreading proceeding with the health care debate without Teddy Kennedy in there.
Although he was a symbol, he wasn't
actively working on the healthcare debate.
That's really the question. I mean, he was a symbol, but as we talked to John Costin there up in Kennebunk, Maine, he's looking for a progressive solution. Very unclear as to whether that will be coming out of the debate in Washington, but it does proceed. A quick update now on how Teddy Kennedy's departure from the scene affects the debate in Washington. She's the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner and joins us from the nation's capital. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, John.
You know, we had some glimpses yesterday that this was going to mobilize Democrats to maybe get more serious about health care reform. But we also had some glimpses that, in a sense, maybe there's relief among some, either in the Democratic Party or in the conservative wings of the GOP, that this is a chance to lay to rest the progressive agenda on health care. What do you think's going on?
Well, this was definitely Kennedy's signature issue. He really wanted to get this done. And sure, there's going to be a push to name the bill for him, sort of wrap up health care reform in the Kennedy brand and trying to get it through. That's not going to happen. I mean, there's going to be a few days of somber mourning here in Washington, D.C., and then it's going to revert right back to the debate we were having a week ago.
And the naming of the bill issue, it seems to me, is a double-edged sword. We talked about it a little bit yesterday. I mean, Everyone remembers how the Humphrey-Hawkins Full Employment Act actually gave us all jobs. You know, naming a bill doesn't necessarily do anything, right?
No, and it certainly doesn't bring moderate Democrats and Republicans on board with health care reform at all.
Is this more of an issue, before we go, for the Democrats in the sense that they really do have to get something done, compromised by partisanship or not?
Yeah, and, you know, he was really a guy to do it. He was a guy to get everyone in a room and start working and put aside all that partisan stuff. And he's gone, and so Obama has really lost a rabbi on this issue. So it's a big setback for the Democrats if they really are serious about getting something done.
But within all the eulogies and the statements over the next few days, we'll probably be able to read some tea leaves about where the debate is actually going. And the Democrats are going to have to accomplish this without Teddy Kennedy there. In the debate itself. Julie Mason,
Indeed.
Thanks so much. White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, trying to figure out where the health care debate goes following the passing of Teddy Kennedy.
Never been so easy or so slow. Been shooting in the dark too long. When something's not right, it's wrong. You're gonna make me lonesome.
So we've been following the healthcare debate very closely on this show, and there are a couple of very crucial decision points. Individual consumers deciding to get insured, right, John?
Right. Lots of them young people who are healthy, who actually don't necessarily even have to do it.
Doctors deciding on treatments based on whether a patient is covered or not.
That's pretty crucial.
And perhaps most critical of all, employers trying to figure out if their businesses can actually afford to provide insurance to their workers. So this week we've talked to people grappling with the first two tough decisions. Today a look at small business owners. Now they employ about half of all American workers, but only 62% of small business employers actually provide a healthcare benefit. And three people joining us this morning for whom healthcare is literally make or break decision for their businesses. John Causton lives in Kennebunk, Maine. Welcome back, John.
Thank you.
Dan Sherry, good morning to you from Barrington, Illinois.
Good morning.
And Rashonda Young joins us from Waterloo, Iowa. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
First of all, I'm going to go around our round table. Healthcare, is it make or break for you, Rashonda?
It is.
Tell me why.
Well, first, we've got 34 employees, and we have families, and when we had initially received quotes about our health plan, we figured it was going to be about $241 on average for an individual, $580 for a family. When our final quotes came back, it ended up being about $414 per month for an individual, close to $1,000 for a family. In order to really attract competitive people to our business to help us to grow, we need something that's affordable, and almost $1,000 a month for a family isn't affordable for us, nor is it affordable for our employees.
Dan, you have fewer employees than Rashonda. You have just 8 employees, but is healthcare make or break for you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's not just for me, it's for America. I'm sorry to correct you, but the 62% of small businesses offering healthcare has decreased. It's less than 50% now.
Really?
And it's continuing to go down. Employers are forced daily to make these decisions. Do we shift the cost to our employees? Do we reduce coverage, or do we just drop coverage? And that's happening. People who say they're happy with their coverage now have to realize that it's going away. it, we can't keep going in this path. And I can't even offer it for my own employees. So, I mean, I am absolutely at a disadvantage. When I run an ad to hire someone, if I have 100 resumes in return, I'll throw out 80 of them, because when they say, do you offer health insurance, and I say no, it's a deal breaker. And in a society where people expect their employer to provide health insurance, that's where they go to get it, and you can't offer it. Trust me, that expression, it's hard to find good help, that's my life.
John Causton, you're in Kennebunk, Maine. You own a veneer services, and your company's called Veneer Services Unlimited, and you provide veneer work for the woodworking industry. You have just 2 employees, so easy, right? Healthcare can't possibly be make or break for you.
Well, it isn't right now, but it's going to be. I mean, I hear Rashonda's story, and I say congratulations, Rashonda, to have grown to that size, and Dan as well. We're at the start point that I imagine you both were at one point. Including myself, there are 3 people working here. I'd like to expand, but just as both of the other business owners mentioned, to attract the best candidates, you really have to offer people the possibility of a career and the possibility of growing with your business. Training for what we do takes quite a long time. It takes several years to really get someone up to speed, and I think that people want to know when they're making that kind of investment in your business of their time and their energy that it's something they can stick with, that they have the possibility of having a family, that if, you know, heaven forbid, they should have to see a doctor, they might be able to afford to do that. So this is really coming in right up on the radar screen for us.
Let me just back up a second. Dan and Rashonda say that it affects your ability to get decent employees, not the ability to offer health care. But you're saying, John, that it's an impediment on expansion if you have to consider health care, that you really can't expand fast enough because health care is such an impediment to growth.
I'm saying the high cost of health insurance is an impediment to growth for small businesses.
You know, Dan, let me ask you one question. Sometimes a really bad problem employee can mess up your health care costs as an employer. Do you have one of those kind of problems?
I would if I was offering health care. It's the unfortunate thing for small business owners. Our group is our employees. If you get a half a dozen and all of a sudden someone has a serious problem, your rates just go through the roof.
Well, who's the serious problem employee in a healthcare category in your business?
My assistant manager. She's got serious medical problems. I have another employee actually who is seriously considering filing bankruptcy because I can't offer health insurance. She had an incident a few years ago, and the only debt she has she carries is a hospital bill, and they just took her to court, and now they're telling me I have to impound her wages. And we're looking at her filing bankruptcy. It happens. It's a tragedy in America.
John, you're the smallest out of all of our small business. You just got a couple of employees. What are you looking to get out of healthcare reform so that you can actually get bigger, stronger, make more money?
We need to have affordable health care in this country. We need to be able to provide that backstop for myself and my employees that's not going to break the bank. At current rates, we cannot afford insurance, and we really can't afford to have unhealthy employees.
Okay, so John Causton, for you, the takeaway is a federal subsidy to allow you to expand and to offer health care. Dan, what would be the takeaway for you? What do you need to hear out of Washington?
I'm not interested in a federal subsidy, frankly. That's taking the tax dollars, giving it back to us so that we can spend it on private insurance and line the pockets of the private insurance industry. I need a public option.
Public option.
That's going to bend the cost curve so we reduce costs. I need access, but I need a lower cost. And if the government giving me the money to make it affordable isn't going to lower costs.
Thanks very much, Dan. Dan Sherry is in Barrington, Illinois, where he owns one small business in 2 locations, Kennedy's Creative Awards and the ID Store. John Causton is the owner of Veneer Services Unlimited. And Rashonda Young, who owns her father's business, Alpha Express, talked to us from Waterloo, Iowa. Thank you all.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Femi OK.
Hello there.
There are a lot of Kennedys. Can you count them all?
I wish I could.
It's an Irish Catholic family.
We don't have time.
Hundreds and hundreds. We're also learning this week there were a lot of Teddy Kennedys. A lot
right,
of different
okay.
Teddy Kennedys. And
yes,
in all the eulogies, we're hearing a lot of this.
Iraq is George Bush's Vietnam. As with Vietnam, the only rational solution to the crisis is political, not military. Injecting more troops into a civil war is not the answer.
The principled leftist, the lion of the Senate, the patriarch of the Senate. But there were a lot of Teddy Kennedys down through the years. He had a very, very long political career. Mm-hmm. Joining us now is William Weld, former governor of Massachusetts, Republican, colleague, collaborator, and I think it's fair to say someone who tangled with Teddy Kennedy. Good morning, William Weld.
Hey, John. Good to be with you.
It's great to be with you. You know, I have a real question listening to some of the eulogizing over the last few years. You know, Teddy Kennedy was known in the 70s as a pretty arrogant fellow who botched his 1980 presidential campaign and really was the rallying cry for the Reagan Republicans in the 1980s in their whole tax and spend program. When did Teddy Kennedy earn Republicans' respect and become this kind of bipartisan guy?
Oh, I think his career was built not in a day. It was built over years and years of serious study of the issues in the Senate. You know, I knew Ted Kennedy for 40 years. He was in the Senate already in his seat when I worked for Senator Jack Javits of New York in the 60s. And I saw him more socially in the 70s out at Hickory Hill when I was down in Washington working their place.
That was
in
Bobby. That was Bobby Kennedy's place, right?
Yeah, but Teddy was there a lot.
Sure, sure.
By the 80s, we were both, you know, statewide figures in Massachusetts, and that's not that big a pond. So I would bump into him personally in Boston and Washington as well as professionally. But he was, I never did tangle with him. I found him the easiest guy in the world to work with. He was absolutely without paranoia, and he had the best staff on the Hill for decades, and they'd always briefed him perfectly. So he was the one senator, even when I was at the criminal division of the Justice Department handling, you know, criminal investigations, who would always meet me alone. He never had to have staff in the room to, you know, make sure everything went okay, and how can we help, and, you know, we'll help the Justice Department here. Absolutely straight, absolutely professional. And then how about Southie? What do you hear from the Cape? What's new in Western Mass? So we had a lot in common. I think probably the relationship was not hurt by the fact that we never ran against each other. But
probably not.
You know, that's not necessary.
All right. Well, certainly one of the reasons, conceivably, and that can be our takeaway there, of why he got so much done. What you saw was what you got with Teddy Kennedy, particularly if you were working.
If you hear him giving a speech, it was always obvious that he meant what he said. The heart was connected to the head, and it wasn't just a speech that somebody'd written for him. When you talked to him, there was no plexiglass shield between you and him. Maybe he'd pause, maybe he'd grumble a little bit if he wasn't happy with what was going on in the conversation, but it was absolutely natural. And the humor would always bubble to the surface. The humor would always relieve whatever stress of the different positions there was.
Well, which is why he'll be missed, that's for sure. William Weld,
right.
Former governor of Massachusetts, thanks so much for being with us.
Great. Thanks.
So, John, from our coverage yesterday, from all of the plaudits coming about Senator Ted Kennedy, it's obvious that he is going to be missed by a whole spectrum of people, but perhaps most by Massachusetts Democrats. They have a huge void to actually fill. So for a look at who is topping a list of potential successors, we are joined by Frank Phillips. He is the State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. He's also covered the Massachusetts State House for nearly 40 years. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Simeon.
So, Frank, your senator dies, he gets replaced. Simple, right? Or what's going on in Massachusetts that makes it a little bit more complicated?
Well, probably you could go back to 2004 when John Kerry looked like he had a shot at becoming the next president and there would be a Senate vacancy, but we had a Republican in the governor's office, and the Democrats, both nationally and in Massachusetts, did not want that Republican, Mitt Romney, to make an appointment. So they set up a special election process. It takes 5 months to go along, and they did not make any provision for an interim appointment or somebody to hold that office during that 5 months. And now They are looking to amend that law now to allow a Democrat who's in the office, Deval Patrick, to make that interim appointment.
Uh-huh. So who's topping the shortlist as far as you're concerned?
Well, you have two things. You have the interim appointment, which everybody wants a commitment from that person not to run in the special election. And then you have people who are obviously going to look at the special election, get the permanent appointment or election. It's merely speculation. It's up to if this goes through the legislature, and there's some resistance to it. For an interim appointment, it would be somebody with some stature who does not look for a political future, like perhaps even Michael Dukakis. That name has been bandied around.
Really?
Yes. And there are, you know, there could be others, you know, but I don't think I was with the governor yesterday, and he just I asked him about it, and he just said, "I'm just not thinking about that at this point. It's so far down the line."
What about this is a famous senator position that's been held by Kennedys for so many years. Is there any chance that another Kennedy might fill that spot?
Well, I think in the general, in the special election, there is. Everybody's that'll determine the shape of that race. Vicky Kennedy, the senator's widow. People have speculated that she would be a very strong candidate. Whether she's interested or not, she's not shown her hand on that at all. Some people think she would not do it. Others say she'll definitely do it.
Frank, what about the idea that any Kennedy who ran would just get the job? True or false?
Any Kennedy who gets into it, pretty much any Kennedy who gets into it, would be a very strong candidate. Depends on the Kennedy again. Joe Kennedy, the former congressman, he would be a very strong candidate. He's been out there, been through the process, and he would know how to conduct himself on the campaign trail. And there would have a wide reach of fundraising ability across the country. There's still a lot of juice to the Kennedy name in Massachusetts, and I think it would clear a lot of the field. If one of the younger, inexperienced Kennedys got into it, I think you'd see that would be problematic for the family to hold that seat.
Thanks, Frank. Frank Phillips is the State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, doing some speculation for us about who might succeed Senator Ted Kennedy. Now time for a quick look at the headlines. John?
Well, we've got the FDIC, which is going to announce how much is left in its insurance fund. The agency covers ordinary deposits when banks fail, and it's been burning through that fund. The Centers for Disease Control says a White House panel may have overestimated how many people could die from H1N1, the swine flu. The CDC disagrees with the White House number of 90,000 deaths. In Afghanistan, U.S. service member is dead after a militant attack. That means August is now tied as the deadliest month for U.S. troops there since the war began. July was the previous one. They're tied. Key economic reports coming out in just a moment. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Femi LK. We got another update from the not as bad as we thought department.
That's good.
Yes. Well, yeah, it's trying to assess whether the economy has actually hit bottom and is starting to turn around. We do have a GDP number for the second quarter, the gross domestic product. The economy shrank for a record fourth straight quarter, but it was a 1% drop, and that was better than expected. The number also released just a moment ago. The weekly jobless claims declined. It was expected to be a decline. It declined by 10,000. Join us to talk about these numbers and whether the expectations game was met or if we folded this time around. Gus Fauché, Director of Macroeconomics at MoodysEconomy.com, joined us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Gus, the shrinkage for four consecutive quarters is very, very significant, but the futures traders seem to be positively reacting to this idea that the shrinkage was less than we thought, a 1% decline in the economy for the second quarter.
Yes, and certainly compared to what we've seen over the previous few quarters, that 1% decline is much smaller, and I think it's setting the stage for an actual expansion in the third quarter of 2009.
And let's just look at the trend, and again, we've also got revisions and things, so these numbers do tend to move around. I mean, at its worst, we were looking at a 6% annual shrinkage in the last quarter of last year, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yes, that's right. And it shrank just about the same amount in the first quarter of this year as well, which is really quite unprecedented. I mean, we certainly haven't seen anything like that since the Great Depression. So, I mean, certainly you don't want to see the economy shrinking at all, but the fact that it only contracted 1% in an annual pace in the second quarter is pretty good news.
So does that mean that we're improving by a matter of, you know, 80% or so, since 1% is a, you know, a fraction of 6%?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly the economy shrank a lot less in the second quarter than it did in the first quarter of 2009, last quarter of 2008. I think more importantly, if you look at the current quarter, we're expecting to see growth somewhere of around 2 or 2.5%, which would obviously, an expanding economy is much better. And so I think that the recovery, if it hasn't started, is about to start sometime over the next month or so.
Now, the jobless claims seem to be honing in on a kind of hovering moving average of about 544,000. Claims, 10,000 fewer this week. It's been blipping up and blipping down. Is it possible that we're looking at a maybe more alarming plateau that's going to persist for quite some time?
Well, I certainly think if you look at job losses overall, they've declined from where we were in the beginning of this year. I think we're going to see them. It could be that things have kind of stabilized now. I would expect as growth picks back up to see jobless claims start to decline. But the level that we're seeing now, somewhere around 570,000 or so, that still means that the unemployment rate is likely to be increasing at least for another 6 months or so.
You know, you talked when we spoke to you earlier about the issue of stimulus and federal programs that either encourage business activity or actually result in direct payments to the people who are unemployed, that those are keeping certain aspects of the economy afloat. And so if you pull those out, maybe you're looking at shrinkage again. Let's talk about the employment numbers for a moment. At a certain point, unemployment compensation is going to run out. When that happens, what is the impact on retail spending, those sorts of things?
Well, certainly, I mean, that's bad news. You've had workers who have been unemployed for a very long period of time. We do have some programs in place that normally benefits last for about 6 months. We have programs in place to extend those, but I think that the government needs to look at extending them again simply because the unemployment rate is now at about 9.4%, likely to get closer to 10%. You're going to have a lot of people out of work, and if those folks lose their benefits and start to cut back even more on their spending, then the economy could be in trouble again.
All right, so that would definitely be a lag. So if we look in the GDP numbers, is there a way to see which sectors of the economy were maybe directly affected by stimulus programs from the Obama administration and which sectors of the economy are actually growing on their own without assistance, which could be the real sort of green shoots of a real recovery?
Well, I mean, certainly, if you look at consumer spending, that was shrinking very sharply in the second half of 2008. That's stabilized, so some of that is going to be due to the stimulus. Some of it's also due to the fact that I think consumers panicked, and perhaps they're not quite as panicky now. Government spending, obviously, that's because of the stimulus. State and local governments, which had been subtracting from growth earlier, are now adding to growth, and I think that's a direct result of the stimulus and the aid of the state governments that was included there. And then finally, business investment is starting to turn around. It's shrinking, but at a slower pace. And I think that that actually is a good sign of underlying fundamental strength. And I think that we'll continue to see investment improve as conditions start to stabilize a bit.
Are we building up ahead of steam in some sense? I mean, there have been lots of statistics over the last couple of months that consumers, in addition to maybe spending a little bit more, are actually saving a lot more, and that the money as it accumulates in savings accounts, while it doesn't help the economy much in these month-to-month figures, at a certain point will begin to make its way into the economy and consumer spending will move up quite a bit more.
That's right. I think consumers have undertaken a very large retrenchment in recent months. I think that process is about over. I think we're going to see a structurally higher savings rate, but I don't think consumers need to increase their savings more at that point. So that should lead to a stabilization in consumer spending. The higher savings rate is good news over the longer run for the economy. And then also, you know, I think we will see a turnaround in the labor market, but that's still probably another 3 to 6 months off.
Finally, Gus, we talked about this a little bit earlier this morning. How dependent are we for our GDP growth on growth in Europe and China?
Well, we're dependent on it to some extent, but certainly much less so than a lot of other economies. Most of the demand in the United States comes internally from consumers and businesses within the United States. A global economic pickup certainly will help the U.S. economy, but it's not going to be the deciding factor. What's going to be the deciding factor is whether consumers and firms in the U.S. decide they want to spend again, and that depends on confidence.
Gus Fauché, Director of Macroeconomics at Moody's Economy.com via phone in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us, Gus.
Thank you.
Now, Femi has some headlines that we're following.
Thank you, John. Senator Ted Kennedy will be laid to rest in Arlington National Cemetery on Saturday. And before that, his body will lie in repose at the JFK Presidential Library in Boston. Thousands are expected to pay respects starting today. The future of Kennedy's Senate seat is under discussion. In a recent letter, Kennedy asked lawmakers to change the law to allow an immediate replacement. Democratic Governor Deval Patrick now says he supports Kennedy's wish. Right now, the law says the seat will be empty until a special election.
Overseas, Iran's supreme leader is rejecting accusations made by hardline officials that opposition leaders responsible for organizing post-election protests are foreign agents. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei says it's not proven they were agents for countries, including the United States.
Pirates off the coast of Somalia fired on a U.S. Navy helicopter. It was a surveillance flight over a hijacked ship. The Navy says the helicopter was not hit and nobody was injured.
Back in the U.S., NASA teams are done testing the fuel valve that postponed the scheduled launch of Space Shuttle Discovery. It seems to be okay. The next launch attempt is set for early Friday.
And the famed crime writer Dominic Dunn is dead of cancer at 83. Dunn was known for his coverage of the O.J. Simpson murder trial and for other high-profile cases. Those are some of the stories we're watching today.
So how are you feeling, Femi?
Not bad,
Your
John.
Health and the workplace with Beth Kobliner coming right up.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Femi Okay.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We're joined now by Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joins us from London. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
It seems that there's been a lot going on in the background regarding Middle East peace. Let me review a little bit of the bidding here, and then you can explain some of the details. The Obama administration claims it will unveil a Middle East peace plan next month. Benjamin Netanyahu is on his way for a meeting with the Obama administration officials. And the principal issue to get things going seems to be the Obama administration's demand that Israel stop all construction on the West Bank before peace talks can begin. Where do things stand? And the talks that took place this week between Netanyahu and officials in Europe and the Obama administration, did they produce some results?
It appears they produced some results. So the main business of Mr. Netanyahu in Europe was actually to meet an American, George Mitchell, the Obama administration's Middle East envoy. They met high up in a London hotel overlooking Hyde Park yesterday morning. It looks as though there is some progress on this issue of a settlement freeze. If you think back, the Obama administration almost from the outset has put Middle East peace as one of its diplomatic priorities. It believed that the way to do this was as a first step, demanding that Israel freeze all settlement building, as Israel is obliged to do under the terms of a number of existing agreements. The Israelis balked at this. The Americans talked tough. They tried to rally a Jewish opinion in the United States, many of Israel's supporters in the United States. But actually, Mr. Netanyahu has appeared a tougher nut to crack than they might have imagined. So it looks as though they're going to fudge it. The Israelis appear willing to freeze new settlements for a period. They appear willing to freeze expansion of settlements for the moment. But it looks as though they're insisting upon what they call normal life continuing in the settlements, which is a euphemism by which they mean some construction will continue.
Well,
John, as much as the Americans are going to get, it looks as though that's what they're going to have to accept.
Well, how these things are fudged sometimes sort of is the place where the cynicism about Middle East peace really gets generated. Let's take a look at that. Natural growth in the settlements, which is sort of the euphemism among Israelis, does that constitute the building of garages on existing properties, or is that something where it looks like a garage to me, but maybe to the Palestinians it looks like a new apartment that was built onto the same building, so it actually constitutes growth? Is that what we're getting into here?
Well, in one sense, we could be getting into that, although I think fundamentally, in a way, it's largely irrelevant. I mean, what is being talked about here is the means to an end, a means to try and get direct talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians going again. That's President Obama's goal. He wants to announce, perhaps at the UN General Assembly, when it meets in September in New York, the restarting of some significant peace process involving the Americans, Israel, and the Palestinians. If he can achieve that, by whatever fudge, that would have been, I think, something of a success. Cynicism is going to abound. There's going to be lots of criticisms. Lots of people are going to think this is going to lead nowhere. But I think the one difference in all of this, the perhaps one small ray of hope, is that this is an American administration which is tackling the Middle East issue head on right at the start of its term of office. There are still 3 more years to go of President Barack Obama. And so there is time to make progress, if indeed progress can be achieved.
Got it. So the takeaway is, even if the settlement freeze is above freezing temperature, there's still enormous incentive for this to proceed and for talks to begin, right,
indeed,
Jonathan?
Indeed. If it gets the Palestinians back to the table, all will be for the best.
Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Femi. Okay, so if you get sick, it affects your work, right?
Yes.
That's
obviously
pretty obvious.
Yes, yes, yes.
But worrying about work can actually make you sick.
Oh, no. Vicious circle.
It's a vicious circle, exactly. And we're going to talk about it in just a few minutes. And we're also talking about health care. And we want to know from you, when you're young and healthy, is it worth it to pay for health insurance? Tell us your story. We've heard lots of them. We want to hear more. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, some of the news stories we're following this morning include two big economic numbers, which are just out this morning. The second quarter gross domestic product report shows the U.S. economy shrank for a record fourth straight month, but the 1% drop was better than expected. New weekly jobless claims are down. 570,000 people applied for jobless benefits last week. The total number of people on unemployment is also down. It was a drop by 10,000. Ted Kennedy's family gathered for a private mass at noon today after the Cape Cod service. His body will be taken to the JFK Presidential Library in Boston.
And people on the East Coast should keep an eye out for Tropical Storm Danny. Eric Blake is tracking the storm for the National Hurricane Center.
It could reach hurricane strength. Right now we're forecasting some low strengthening, and we think late on Friday it could become a hurricane.
Danny has winds of 60 miles an hour, and those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
So for our segment on workplace issues this week, another reminder, as if we needed one, of the linkage between the economy and healthcare and healthcare and the economy. We've already talked with small business owners who have enormous problems economically dealing with healthcare for their
employees.
Absolutely.
And they want to have healthcare, but they can't afford
it. And we also know that healthcare costs are one of the leading causes of bankruptcies in the United States.
That's stunning.
It's also the case that in a recession, stress goes up, and that leads to all sorts of health consequences for workers, which then sorts of complicates the issue of healthcare reform and insurance. Here to talk about the issues in the workplace in the middle of a recession, particularly stress and what it's doing to your body, Beth Kobliner joins us, personal finance expert, Takeaway's personal finance contributor. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
Also joining us is Elizabeth Lombardo, a psychologist and physical therapist from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, public radio station WDUQ. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
First of all, in a recession, it certainly doesn't take a doctor to conclude that recessions produce all kinds of anxiety, and that's going to have healthcare consequences. But get to the specifics, won't you?
Right. Well, first of all, I think that people are obviously stressed out. In fact, there's this professor at the University of New Hampshire who's called it post-downsizing stress syndrome. People are overwhelmed. They see their colleagues laid off. And these are the people who still have jobs because they're worried about losing their job. And it's the survivors at the workplace who are sort of picking up the slack and experiencing these high levels of stress. And health can suffer from stress, as we all know.
Right, but that's the sort of obvious part.
Right.
Elizabeth, when you begin to see patients who are coming in with some of the consequences of this, what are you seeing, and how are they maybe less able to take care of themselves?
Well, stress really affects our bodies in two main ways, physiologically and behaviorally. So physiologically, our immune system doesn't work as well, and so we're more likely to get colds and flus. Musculoskeletal muscles tend to be tense, and so we have more pain. GI system can be affected. I even have patients who are losing their hairs because of the stress. So physiologically is one way, but then behaviorally is the other. When we're stressed, we're less likely to take care of ourselves, right? We're less likely to sleep. We're less likely to exercise or eat right.
Does that include you're less likely to go see the doctor? You're less likely to schedule an appointment.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what we're seeing. The American Academy of Family Physicians says that people are cutting out routine visits. They're canceling checkups and follow-up visits. OBGYN visits are down 6% this year, for example. And what we're seeing is as people are basically distracted because they're so concerned, healthcare comes lower down on the totem pole for them. You know, they're worried about so many other things that they're not taking care of their own bodies.
So as Congress, the House and Senate talk about more prevention and getting better healthcare strategies in place, Elizabeth, you're seeing the recession is actually causing people to put preventive strategies out the window.
Exactly. And not only because of the financial component, but also because one aspect of stress is procrastinating. We put off what we should be doing because we're so stressed out.
Oh, that's so interesting. So, all right, you're both describing to me a situation that's kind of feeding on itself and rolling down a hill, getting bigger and bigger. How, as an individual, can you take steps to actually stop the cycle? Elizabeth, you first, and then we'll end with Beth.
Well, I developed an acronym called GREAT, G-R-E-A-T, and it gives us five steps of what we can do. As Beth pointed out, a lot of the stress is caused by our thoughts. So instead of looking at what we don't have, G would be gratitude, appreciate what we do have. R is relaxation, take some deep breaths, meditate.
Okay.
E is exercise.
Exercise, okay, good. No, I'm trying to work it through here.
John's writing it down really quickly on a piece of paper.
He was taking that deep breath. So E is exercise. There's research that shows that exercise really combats the negative effects of depression and stress. A is assist others. When we help out others, we're more likely to feel better about our own lives.
Oh, that's interesting.
And T is to take care of ourselves. Get the checkups that we need. Get the sleep. Eat well.
Right.
Let me just say that's great, Elizabeth Lombardo, psychologist and physical therapist at WDUQ in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I hope I didn't stress you out by rushing you along there. We're right at the end of the hour. Beth Koblenner, final thoughts?
Well, basically, look at your health plan. If you still have your job, take time to remind yourself how your health care works. Are you entitled to a free dental appointment? And know that if you do lose your job, there are some things in place, like COBRA. The government will pay for 65% of your health care costs if you lose your job for 9 months. Drug companies now are saying if you're laid off for a year, they'll pay for your drugs for a year. So there are things in place. Look at what you have and make sure to go to the doctor.
Settle down, relax, don't procrastinate. Go to our website. We'll tell you what GREAT means. Elizabeth Lombardo, thanks so much. Beth Koblenner, Takeaway personal finance contributor, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
There's the deafening sound of the national healthcare debate.
Oh, I know that.
But on this program, it's a different sound.
This is Curtis from Oklahoma City. I've got health insurance, and they're not paying for anything that I need. So I'm actually about to call and drop my health insurance. And I'm 25.
This week, we asked young people like Curtis to tell us about their decision whether to get health insurance, and they answered. Take a listen to what Lynn says. She's a teacher in New York.
I'm 23 years old, and I was told last year that the health insurance given to me by the city of New York does not cover physicals for anyone between the age of 19 and 45, give or take, but that I could have an OBGYN checkup once a year. I think, as someone who's 23 and who'd like to stay in good health, that this is incredibly short-sighted. The long-term cost to myself for developing a chronic condition that could have been detected and the long-term cost to everyone else who pays for health insurance are really unacceptable.
You know, I just love the way these people absolutely have the issue clearly in hand and are outraged by the arbitrary decisions that some of these insurance companies are making.
Right.
And so we're having healthcare roundtables all week. We've talked with young people about these kinds of decisions. We've talked with doctors about the choices they have to make with their patients. We talked with small business owners earlier in the hour. You can go to our website, thetakeaway.org, and hear what people have been saying and whether they've chosen coverage or not. It's still a gamble.
My name's Ricky. I'm from Chicago. I was on COBRA insurance in my last job for about 18 months. It was very expensive. I just recently came off of it. Now I'm one of those people that's uninsured. Is it worth it to pick it up? Well, right now, I mean, for me to get insurance, this is a big part of my weekly income, but in town, I don't want to be at risk. So it's a tough call. I wish there was some other choice out there than entering the individual insurance market for myself.
See, these calls,
you can hear the anxiety. Absolutely. As Beth Kobliner was talking about a moment ago.
True, and we were talking about some of the responses that we were getting in the office the other day, and we said, you know, we can do deals about where we shop, what we do for our fun time, but if we do deals about our health care, maybe we're actually hurting ourselves.
It's tough. Katia writes us on the website, I'm 26, I've always bought health care wherever it's been offered to me. I'm pretty healthy now, but that can change in a heartbeat. My partner found this out when his appendix burst. He figures that it all cost his insurance company about $30,000, and he thanks his lucky stars he bought the super premium plan. In my case, I have to consider the chronic health problems of my mother that, for all I know, I'll develop down the road. But insurance is insurance. We buy knowing and hoping we won't need it.
And John, that sounds like a big question for a lot of people, whether or not they're young and if they're uninsured and have to buy their own insurance.
My name is Matt. I'm calling from Joplin, Missouri. I'm 25 years old and I lost my job in July. And rather than going for COBRA, I went into my local State Farm office and was able to get health insurance that same day. I did have one surgery earlier in January, so all I had to do was take a higher deductible for that one particular incident.
Okay, so that's one side of the story, but why should young people get health insurance? Here's an argument from a doctor.
This is Garrett Hansel from Dearborn, Michigan. I'm a first-year emergency medicine resident, and I think the nice thing about having a person get health insurance who doesn't think they need it is that they don't know if they need it or not. In the emergency room, that's what we see all the time, is people who don't know or don't want to know or choose not to do anything about something they do know and end up much serious than they otherwise would be if they were receiving regular medical care.
Rolling the dice or being strategic, young people's decisions on health care. Weigh in with yours at 8778-MY-TAKE and follow all of our roundtable discussions at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi Okay. Stay well. This is The Takeaway. $90,000 Americans could die this fall from the H1N1 virus. Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of Health and Human Services, is feeling a little sick these days.
Fever in the morning, a fever all through the night.
We want the population that is most at risk to get their seasonal flu shots now.
Everybody's got the fever.
Covering coughs and sneezes is critical.
Fever isn't such a new thing, fever started long ago.
What if your child needs to be home for 2, 3, 4 days?
How are you feeling? A little anxious, maybe? Don't worry, we'll take care of you, making sense of the swine flu figures today on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning.
Oh,
it's
so
Thursday.
You're going to take care of us?
Personally,
you're going to take care of us
my
all.
My bedside manner. Stand by
have
for that.
No fear. Femi Okay is here.
You're not sick. You can go to work. Good morning. It's Thursday, August the 27th. I'm Femi Okay, and you
and
are?
I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, the tech world has gaga rumors about a new gadget. We'll tell you what's going on here. Ireland loves Senator Ted Kennedy. How's it say goodbye? And a healthcare overhaul is really important for people who have no choice in healthcare. They have chronic illnesses. We're going to hear from some patients themselves.
But first, let's talk to a doctor, Dr. Howard Varmus. He's the co-chair of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology and president of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Now, the big story this week about H1N1 or swine flu came from a report out that said that saying 90,000 people could die from H1N1. Now, Dr. Varmus, you were part of writing that report, but you didn't like the way the story was reported. What headline would you have written?
Well, we don't think that the numbers were the main point. The numbers were there to give a sense of where things could go. The headline we would like was expert panel recommends actions against the likely fall resurgence of the flu pandemic, warning the public of what's going to happen and making some recommendations of what the public and the government can do.
Okay, not as catchy as 90,000 people could die. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Let's take a look at some other headlines.
So why headlines don't heal people and right. Why doctors don't write headlines. In the headlines, two big economic numbers out this morning. The U.S. economy shrank for a record fourth straight quarter, but it dropped at a rate of 1%. that beat expectations. In the job market, new claims for unemployment benefits were down last week. 570,000 people applied for benefits, 10,000 down, and that also was better than expected. Senator Ted Kennedy's family gathers for a private mass at noon today after the Cape Cod service. The body will be taken to JFK Presidential Library in Boston.
There's talk of a succession to his Senate seat already in Massachusetts. Democratic Governor Deval Patrick now supports Kennedy's recent request to change state law. Kennedy wanted a successor appointed immediately. John.
August is now tied with July as the deadliest month for American troops in Afghanistan, with the death of another U.S. service member. Wall Street was flat yesterday. It opens maybe marginally positive as a result of those economic reports we just told you about. The S&P starts trading at 1028, the NASDAQ at 2024, and the Dow opens today at 9544. In our healthcare debate, young people have been crucial. They've had some of the most interesting stories. We want to hear from yours, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. If you're considering insurance, tell us your story.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Femi Okay and John Hockenberry taking care of you this morning. In a moment, what's happening in Afghanistan after their recent presidential elections? But we start this morning with the latest warnings on the H1N1 virus. Now, earlier on this week, a presidential panel warned that the virus could kill up to 90,000 Americans and send 300,000 people to the hospital. Joining us now to discuss what this means for hospitals and the public is one of the report's authors, Dr. Howard Varmus. Dr. Varmus is a co-chair for the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And also, good morning to Dr. Jeev Kalina. He's the Associate Director of Emergency Medicine with the Methodist Hospital in Houston. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Varmus, welcome back again.
Thank you.
The figures out this week, 90,000, were alarming. How scared should we be?
Well, I think people should feel that there is a serious danger of the flu resurging. That is the new flu, a flu to which most people have not been exposed, at a level that could cause fairly widespread illness and death. And we know enough about this virus from its appearance here in the spring. We know enough about influenza from the appearance of many epidemics in the past to be able to make some general scenarios, not predictions, because flu is notorious producing something that may be different from what we think it's going to produce. But that kind of planning, which has to be based on numbers, the numbers of people infected, the number with symptoms, the number who go to doctors, the number who go to hospitals or need intensive care units, and the number who might die, provides a way to think about how to mitigate, that how to soften the impact of an expected resurgence. And there are many ways, many tools available for trying to mitigate an infection of this kind: vaccines, antiviral drugs, use of hospital facilities, especially intensive care units, and then social actions that can be taken by individuals and by government and other institutions.
Dr. Varmus,
yes.
What was confusing me in the news this morning was the CDC said that the figure of 90,000 was really a gross overestimate. I don't want to get bogged down in an argument about numbers, but how helpful is that to what you're trying to do in terms of getting the message out?
Well, I think that's arguable. I don't think it is a gross overestimate. I think it's on the high side. But if you're going to do emergency planning, it's important to have to start with a scenario that has a range, and actually the range was up to 90,000. That was our high number. We bracketed the numbers from 30,000 to 90,000. Seasonal flu every year produces about 36,000 deaths in the U.S. So the 30,000 number may be conceived as on the conservative side, 90,000 on the higher side. But if you're going to do planning for an impending epidemic, you don't want to think about the remote possibilities, which would be 10 times higher, as might have occurred in 1918, when our population was smaller, but we had a very different kind of flu. You want to be prepared for things that could be pose very difficult problems.
All right, well, you definitely got our attention with the 90,000 number. Dr. Jeev Kalina, you're the director of an emergency center at a hospital in Texas. What are you doing with that piece of information, that data, in terms of getting prepared?
Well, I also direct the disaster response for the entire Texas Medical Center, which is the largest medical center in the world. And we prepare on several levels. Not only do we expect each hospital to be able to come up with a plan to handle what we call a surge capacity, but we also kind of as a community want to have a community-wide and a community plan, which we've had in place since October of 06 for any kind of pandemic flu. Some of the things that hospitals can do, for example, would be to educate their staff, their faculty, their residents on good flu hygiene, getting the message out to folks about flu hygiene and the contacting their physician should they get sick.
Dr. Kalina, is there any chance that with a high number of 90,000 possible deaths from H1N1 virus all the way through this fall, is it possible that you could be absolutely swamped and can't cope with this this swine flu?
Well, yes, these kind of surges are unlike a disaster. If God forbid we had an explosion at a stadium or something like that, where you might have 10,000 people swamp the medical center within minutes to hours. This kind of surge takes place over weeks and months, and certainly over our flu season, we did notice a bump in our volume, and we will see an increase in our volume. But since this surge is spread out over months, it's something that the hospital we make contingency plans for to expect that extra volume.
But that's the mathematical issue that troubles me, though. And let me just get a quick takeaway from Dr. Varmus. I mean, on the one hand, I can imagine a town of 90,000 dropping dead in an hour. That's pretty horrific. But if I divide, 90,000 by the entire population of the United States, close to 300 million. It seems like a really positive number. My chance of getting killed or hurt by the flu is remote.
That's true. And that is not remote, but it's certainly very small. What we emphasize in the report is there are a number of identified risk groups, people under the age of four, people with asthma, other respiratory diseases, pregnant women in the late stages of pregnancy who are at particularly high risk. And we agree this is going to be over a period of time. Nevertheless, intensive care units in particular tend to operate nearly at capacity. Dr. Kalima is right. He sounds like he's got preparedness on his mind, and that's very good. But flu doesn't appear at equal frequencies throughout the country. There may be communities in which there are little bursts of very sick people, as many as 8 or 10 or 15, can severely stress a hospital's intensive care unit. And we're not predicting something that would be like Katrina, focused on just a few days of activity. But given the scarcity of certain kinds of equipment, particularly pediatric respirators, there could be a severe need to do things like share equipment among hospitals, be prepared to bring in equipment from other areas of the country.
Dr. Howard Varmus, I'm going to leave it there. We'll revisit you as we head further into the swine flu season. Thank you very much, Dr. Howard Varmus. He's the co-chair of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology and also the president of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And also thank you to Dr. Jeff Kalina. He's the Associate Director of Emergency Medicine with the Methodist Hospital in Houston. John.
That's really interesting stuff, that the shortage of equipment could be a bottleneck. So even a small burst in a small community could be devastating for an emergency room.
So the thing is, be prepared.
Yes, indeed. Now we turn to James Risen, the investigative reporter for The New York Times, who has an exclusive in The New York Times this morning, which says what we all knew, at least in principle, that the threshold for political corruption in Afghanistan is maybe a different standard than we're used to here in the United States. James Risen, first of all, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
What are we to make of the allegations against Hamid Karzai's running mate in the post-election days and weeks as we come to the final count? It looks like Hamid Karzai is ahead of Abdullah in the Afghan election. In the a few minutes before we go here, how are Afghanis dealing with these allegations and what's to be made of both Hamid Karzai's tactics during the election and his running mate?
Well, his running mate is Marshal Mohammed Fahim, who was the military commander of the Northern Alliance during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, and he is one of the classic warlords of Afghanistan. He's been allegations against him of narcotics trafficking during when he was defense minister in 2002. CIA reports came in about his involvement in narcotics trafficking in 2002 during the Bush administration. And my story is kind of about how the Bush administration suppressed and ignored the evidence, turned a blind eye to it, and allowed him to didn't try to push him out as defense minister. And now he's back, and the Obama administration is struggling with how to deal with him.
Now, is it a struggle, or do they really have no choice but to look the other way and let Karzai proceed? He has to make deals with the devil to function in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, well, that's what Karzai is saying. And Secretary of State Clinton tried to tell Karzai not to appoint and name him as running mate, and he did it anyway. And now the State Department is thinking about sanctions they could impose if he is elected, including keeping him out of the United States. But you're right, there's very little at this point they can do, and it's the great dilemma for the Obama administration. As they send in thousands of more American troops, they find themselves propping up a government that is riddled with corruption.
Indeed.
And they're not quite sure what to do about it.
Obama's dilemma. James Risen, investigative reporter for the New York Times. Finding clout in Afghanistan will help projecting democracy. Thank you, James.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So, Femi, I like to start these Thursday tech discussions pretty low tech.
Are you going to do your voice?
No.
Please,
what do they say? What do they say about you cry wolf too many times and what happens?
Yeah, no one comes to help you.
No one pays any attention to you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So why do people pay attention when, once again, people like Steve Jobs talk like this?
An iPod, a phone, and an internet communicator.
Ooh.
An iPod.
Ooh.
A phone.
But it's Steve Jobs. It's exciting.
Yeah, he's not crying wolf exactly. The cry is the cry for convergence. That's the sort of end of days in the tech world where all devices will converge to one platform. You'll have
Excellent.
Your internet device, your phone.
Everything
your
need.
Everything. That's right. Sam Grobart joins us, New York Times personal technology editor. He's here in the studio. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, John.
And also joining us from L.A. is Queena Kim, produces the podcast Cyber Frequencies at public radio station KPCC. Queena, I guess you were up all night downloading manga MP3s and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Actually, I just woke up. So.
Yes. Okay. Well, good morning to you. To both of you, it seems that we've had various talk from computer companies, Apple and others, Microsoft, that we're moving to this moment where everything's going to converge. First of all, Sam, what's the latest from Apple? They're suggesting that there's something new that's going to do what they said the iPhone actually would do.
Well, the latest from Apple is, as usual, pretty much nothing at all. The company is legendarily secretive about their future product plans, and so they keep saying, we have nothing to say. We have an event on September 9th that generally and historically has been the introduction of a new line of iPods, and that may be all that it is. There may be something else. The famous line that Steve Jobs says during many of these press conferences is, oh, one more thing. And then he rolls out the big, crazy new thing.
Well, Queena Kim, what could it be? I mean, if Apple is rolling out its latest rumor, what could the gadget that follows behind the rumor actually be?
Well, it seems like there's a lot of talk about the tablet. I don't know if you've heard about this, but it's sort of like a device that's about the size of a notebook, but about, you know, half as large or in width of a computer, and seems to do all sort of the light functions of that device. It's Microsoft had developed an operating system for this in the early 90s, and computer makers like Dell and HP have sort of jumped into the game. But I've never really heard of them until this Apple stuff, all the buzz has been coming out.
The,
so I guess they're going to be...
it's called? The tablet?
Yeah, the tablet. Well, they're calling it the Apple tablet. I mean,
is
you know,
that like,
the blogosphere is...
Like, is that like the, say, Newton?
Where is Newton? Newton's in small towns and hamlets. Newton's in the urban jungle. Newton can get you from the urban jungle to the nearest hamlet. Newton goes wherever people need to communicate. Newton can send a letter or a memo.
Yeah, yeah, enough of that. Newton, right. It was supposed to be everywhere, correct, Sam Grobart? But it was the sort of tablet computer that Apple introduced back in the 90s, went nowhere.
Newton was sort of the proto-PDA, if you remember the Palm Pilot. The Newton actually came out before that. It had handwriting recognition and other features, but it was kind of a dud. There's still an incredibly devoted, tiny group of people who think the Newton was amazing and are keeping it updated with sort of shareware.
Mm, nice.
Yeah, it's great for them.
Don't want to meet them.
No, no, don't introduce them to your kids.
Sam, you talk about Apple being really tight-lipped. So how come there's so much buzz going around?
Well, it's not uncommon. If you recall, before the iPhone was released in January of 07, there was a ton of speculation about Apple's coming out with the iPhone, or they're calling it the Jesus phone, or what other people were talking about. But, you know, basically, people are always looking for the next big thing from Apple.
Like, I don't want to do like a four-minute Apple commercial here, you guys. I mean,
with all
due respect. But Queen of Kim, I mean, it seems to me the technology issue here is one thing. But on this question of convergence, it's the users that actually decide whether this is going to work or not. I mean, we've got Kindle now. We've got this tablet maybe up in the stars somewhere. We already talked about the Newton. There are already PDAs and smart touch phones and things. When do the users decide that actually convergence is going to happen, Quina?
Well, I don't know. I sort of feel like convergence has happened with the iPhone, you know, and the way that this is sort of like all the rumors in the blogs has been that it's sort of like a bigger iPhone. And I've been trying to wrap my head around this about like what exactly is going to take this further, and I can't quite figure out what's going to make me want to buy this rather than just an iPhone or iPod Touch.
Hmm. What would be your convergent device if you could have everything on one device? What would it look like?
Internet would be good.
Internet, computer.
I mean, all
of those.
But
that's an iPhone. You've got that probably in your phone.
I'm trying to think of something that I haven't got. A radio would be good to have. A radio.
You can do that on your iPhone.
Oh, then I'm done.
See, I guess the question is, if convergence actually ever happens, there'd be two things I'd be worried about. One, there'd be landfills everywhere suddenly filled with desktops and laptops. It would be filled to the top. And how much would such a thing cost, Sam?
Well, the latest craze, obviously, in the personal computing world has been the netbook.
Right.
And that's been a sort of $500 or less computing device, and it's a small laptop.
And some people are saying this rumor from Apple might be a netbook play.
It could be a netbook play. Apple doesn't have anything in the netbook space. But at the same time, Steve Jobs has said in a conference call with analysts, if we tried to make a computer for $500, it would be very hard to do that without it being lousy.
Oh, really?
You know, that they don't see the way that you can make something that inexpensive be up to the standards that Apple tends to have for their kinds of products.
Queenie, you already said that the iPhone kind of is what we're talking about already. I think I mostly agree with you, but where does the Kindle fit in and other ebook platforms? Do they have the chance to grow beyond simply a book platform?
I guess, you know, I tried out a Kindle for a little while, and they have that sort of wireless connectivity where you can get it anywhere. But when I tried it out, it was still sort of primitive. I didn't really see where else it could go other than sort of maybe copying the iPhone, really, or the iPod Touch. So I'm not sure how much more there is. Like, it's not a touch screen, you know, and it's not very sophisticated. So having used it, I don't really see it being a competitor. Hmm.
Well, until they announce something concrete, we can dream of an Apple tablet. Where it fits into this other sort of universe is unclear. And I guess the takeaway is that it will be the users who decide what convergent device will actually live on. Queena Kim produces the podcast Cyber Frequencies at KPCC Public Radio in Pasadena. And Sam Grobart's New York Times personal technology editor right here in the studio. Thanks to you both.
And now a look at some of the headlines making news this morning. New claims for unemployment benefits are down. A new report this morning shows that 570,000 people applied for benefits. The total number of people on unemployment rolls also down. In other financial news today, the FDIC will soon disclose how much money is left in its own accounts. The agency covers ordinary deposits when banks fail, and there are worries that many recent failures could push it into the red.
He'll be laid to rest in Arlington National Cemetery on Saturday, but before that, Senator Ted Kennedy's body will lie in repose at the JFK Presidential Library in Boston, where thousands are expected to pay respects. In Afghanistan, another U.S. troop death means August was the deadliest month for American troop forces since the war began. It's now tied with the next most deadly month, which was last month, July. Those are the top stories we're following today. Coming up, what does Ted Kennedy mean to Ireland? Ireland says goodbye to the Senate.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
The tune is called The Boys of Wexford.
It's beautiful.
Yes. And the Boys of Wexford relates very directly to the Kennedys.
Explain.
Well, Femi Okay. I'm John Hockenberry here on The Takeaway. As we spoke about yesterday in remembering the passing of Teddy Kennedy, people in Ireland have very strong connections to the Kennedys. And every Irish-American family can look at a map of Ireland and figure out what town they came from. The Kennedy ancestral town is Wexford. This song is The Boys of Wexford. But every sort of mantelpiece in Ireland has a picture of JFK. People grew up knowing the trials and tribulations of the Kennedy family. And so the passing of Teddy Kennedy is a big moment in Ireland as well as the United States. Neil O'Dowd joins us, founder and editor of IrishCentral.com. He's here in the studio. Neil, good morning.
Good morning, John.
What are the Kennedy connections to Ireland today? Certainly down through history and during the heyday of JFK, and Joe Kennedy was when he was ambassador to Britain during World War II. These were big, big moments. But what about today? We're into the third, fourth generation.
Huge connection still. The Irish peace process was in many ways driven from the United States, and the man who drove it from the United States was Senator Edward Kennedy. He was the person who in many ways was the puppeteer behind the Clinton visa for Gerry Adams, which was a huge element to the Irish peace process. In 1994, President Clinton gave Gerry Adams, then the leader of Sinn Féin, a visa to come to America. He could not have done that unless Teddy Kennedy had been firmly behind it, because Teddy is the go-to guy on Ireland for every American politician and every Irish prime minister who comes over here. There's a welcome mat outside the Kennedy office, obviously. And so Teddy Kennedy became a huge part of that story, and yesterday I think all the tributes from Ireland refer to that very directly, that without Teddy Kennedy there would not be peace in Northern Ireland today.
Now, yesterday we also spoke with Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe, who said that while British nationalists often criticize the Kennedys for being a part of the whole IRA infrastructure politically, that in fact, from his experience, Teddy was very much even-handed in his dealings with the IRA and with dealing with the Protestants regarding the Northern Ireland Troubles.
Yeah, he understood the complexity of the situation. It was always said about Teddy that he was more Irish than Harvard, and that his brother John F. was more Harvard than Irish. But Teddy had the Irish thing in his heart. He was a big Irish politician. He was beloved for that. And he had a tremendous amount of influence in Ireland. And when people went to him and talked to him about Northern Ireland, he spoke out, and he spoke out very strongly originally in favour of the IRA. Then he became very nuanced about it. And he basically said, we shouldn't support the IRA. And then in the early 90s, a number of Irish Americans came to him and said they felt that Sinn Féin were about to make a huge departure from supporting violence and looking for a peaceful solution. And he went along with that.
Well, what about the direct connections today? Courtney Kennedy, one of Bobby's kids, married someone from Northern Ireland?
Yes, married Paul Hill, who was one of the Guildford Four, which is one of the great miscarriages of justice in British history. It's a constant flow. I mean, when John F. Kennedy became president of the United States, that was a tremendous day for Ireland as well, because it was the end of the No Irish Need Apply, the end of the discrimination against Irish Catholics. Suddenly it became very hip to become Irish. Within 10 years, 40 million Americans had decided they had Irish blood in their veins, according to the U.S. Census. About 30 million of them were recently discovered it. So it was like the Barack Obama moment for Irish Americans, basically.
Interesting.
And
it's a moment that will be resonating today as people all over the world say goodbye to Teddy Kennedy.
Absolutely.
Neil O'Dowd, founder and editor of IrishCentral.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'll miss seeing him sailing, which I would do pretty much every time I was out sailing, he was out sailing. He was a pretty good sailor. So in addition to missing him as a senator, I think I'll miss him as a sailor.
The family has been here for a very long time, and, you know, before everyone got very famous, so people have kind of grown with them and seen them grow into positions of power. So it's sort of like your neighbor doing well. I think that, like the vineyard, we leave our celebrities alone.
Just two of the many millions mourning Senator Ted Kennedy, the Kennedy family will hold a private mass at noon Eastern today at his compound in Hyannisport, and then they will accompany the body of the late senator by motorcade to Boston. And for more on how Boston is officially and unofficially mourning the passing of the last of the Kennedy clan, we have Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press. She joins us from member station WGBH in Boston. Good morning.
Good morning, Femi.
Emily, what's the plan for the public viewing of the senator's body today?
Well, as you've probably heard, the senator's body has actually been lying in repose at the home in Hyannisport. We're told that, you know, all of the grandchildren and the children and the relatives are all there. They've been holding a 24-hour vigil, praying at the side of the body since yesterday morning when the body was actually returned to the compound. Then today they're going to do a procession from Hyannisport to the JFK Library in Dorchester. Well, there will be a public viewing, although I understand it's a closed casket. And then tomorrow, of course, the ticket-only service here in the city of Boston.
Are you getting any information about the sort of procession? How will it actually look?
Well, I don't know. I'm sure it will be that there will be some kind of a police escort. I'm sure that there will be live coverage of it. I haven't seen the exact plan or the route yet, but I'm sure the helicopters will be up and we'll be seeing that go. You know, last night, Femi, there was a wonderful moment at Fenway Park. I actually had tickets just serendipitously because I haven't been to the park this year, and I was working late on my own program, so I didn't get there right when it started, but there was this wonderful, wonderful tribute to Ted Kennedy. There was 38,000 people in the ballpark. And it was just a very melancholy moment, as, you know, there was a wonderful tribute that obviously had been prepared in advance. But you get this sense just around the city, and whether you were a Kennedy fan or not, you know, a third of the people of Massachusetts were always sort of in opposition to a Kennedy. But he really was somebody that I think everybody rose above their political feelings when it came to Ted Kennedy. You can just sense that last night at the ballpark. And he loved the Red Sox so much. And right in the end, when David Ortiz hit a walk-off home run, I mean, there was a lot of hugging and tears. And you just sort of said, it was almost like it was in honor of Ted Kennedy. It was just an odd feeling.
Thanks, Emily. It almost felt like we were there as well. Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press and Greater Boston on WGBH-TV in Boston. Now a quick look at some news headlines. John?
A home run to go out on. We all would love that, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
So the latest GDP number just out this morning, it shows the economy shrank for a record fourth straight quarter. Still, 1% contraction is better than expected. Centers for Disease Control disagrees with estimates from a White House panel on how many could die from H1N1, also known as swine flu, when it spikes later this fall. The CDC says that the panel's estimate of up to 90,000 deaths is not likely. NASA teams have tested and okayed the fuel valve, which scrapped yesterday's Discovery shuttle launch, or shuttle Discovery launch. The space agency will try to launch the space shuttle again on Friday. Those are some of the top stories we're following today. Healthcare is a debate for some, but some people have no choice. They have to pay for healthcare. The chronically ill.
Oh, okay, of course.
In just a moment. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. In the end, he was as famous or more famous even than the celebrities he rubbed shoulders with as a movie producer or wrote about as a journalist and novelist. Dominic Dunn, best-selling novelist and Vanity Fair writer, died yesterday at age 83.
I spent 25 years in Hollywood, and some of it was absolutely fabulous, and I loved it. And a lot of it was not fabulous and stunk, and I hated it.
It's Dominic Dunn talking with Larry King during his long career. New York Times reporter and correspondent, we think of him as the ruby-throated voice of broadcast journalism. David Carr joins us now from Los Angeles. Good morning, David.
Yeah,
it's a voice that cries out for radio, and I'm actually in New Jersey, which goes with the voice a little bit.
Oh, but great. Well, of course, this is your stomping ground, just like it was Dominic Dunn's. He covered so many celebrity trials. He was an O.J. celebrity. He covered the Menendez trial, the parent-killing boys who were a scandal back in the early 1990s, the Skakel trial, a big Kennedy scandal that he covered. You rubbed shoulders with Dominic Dunn virtually his whole career.
Well, Dominic was, you know, we were all fleas kind of in his orbit. Dominic knew an entrance. He had his trademark glasses and the white-collared shirt and the suit that was just so and always seemed more of a pasha than a journalist. When he arrived, things sort of changed.
David, this is Femi Oke here. Dominic Dunn, on your Twitter feed, you say that he would not be happy he died on the same day as Ted Kennedy and had to share. What do you think we missed out on from not actually giving him full coverage yesterday?
Well, Dominic had a second act, I think, like few people in America. He really washed out hard as an entertainment producer, had issues with substances, but then came back with the second act where he sold millions of books and absolutely drove coverage in many of the important trials of our day, including the O.J. trial.
You know, I love the fact that his brother, John Gregory Dunn, the late husband of Joan Didion, you know, the high-minded Dunn, and then there was the sort of low Dunn, Dominic Dunn. In many ways, you know, it's kind of a Dunn dynasty there in Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, the thing is he pursued journalism as a kind of prosecution, and he was very, very aggressive and had an ability to sort of create intimacy with victims because his own daughter had been the victim of a crime. And people in various trials came to see him as an advocate, and he ended up with information that no one else had as a result.
His daughter, of course, that you mentioned there was murdered. You know, victim of a crime is a very celebrated
murder. Strangled to death, yes.
And she was a movie star in the movie Poltergeist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and it died tragically, and it altered his career. He quit drinking, became a writer, and became a writer like few others.
You know, I intersected with him very briefly in my own career as part of the enormous number of people who covered the O.J. affair back in the 90s. He was, for all of his personality and strangeness and eccentricity, a very sweet man.
He had an ability to pull you in, to get an arm on you, to whisper to you in a way that made you feel particularly validated and looked after, which was his gift as a journalist.
Charmer, journalist, entertainment icon himself, Dominic Dunn, dead in 83. That's David Carr talking about Dominic Dunn with us. Thank you, David. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. In the end, he was as famous or more famous even than the celebrities he rubbed shoulders with as a movie producer or wrote about as a journalist and novelist. Dominic Dunn, best-selling novelist and Vanity Fair writer, died yesterday at age 83.
I spent 25 years in Hollywood, and some of it was absolutely fabulous, and I loved it. And a lot of it was not fabulous and stunk, and I hated it.
It's Dominic Dunn talking with Larry King during his long career. New York Times reporter and correspondent, we think of him as the ruby-throated voice of broadcast journalism. David Carr joins us now from Los Angeles. Good morning, David.
Yeah, it's a voice that cries out for radio, and I'm actually in New Jersey, which goes with the voice a little bit.
Oh, great. Well, of course, this is your stomping ground, just like it was Dominic Dunn's. He covered so many celebrity trials. He was an O.J. celebrity. He covered the Menendez trial, the parent-killing boys who were a scandal back in the early 1990s, the Skakel trial, a big Kennedy scandal that he covered. You rubbed shoulders with Dominic Dunn virtually his whole career.
Well, Dominic was, you know, we were all fleas kind of in his orbit. Dominic knew an entrance. He had his trademark glasses and the white-collared shirt and the suit that was just so and always seemed more of a pasha than a journalist. When he arrived, things sort of changed.
David, this is Femi Okeh here. Dominic Dunn, on your Twitter feed, you say that he would not be happy he died on the same day as Ted Kennedy and had to share. What do you think we missed out on from not actually giving him full coverage yesterday?
Well, Dominic had a second act, I think, like few people in America. He really washed out hard as an entertainment producer, had issues with substances, but then came back with the second act where he sold millions of books and absolutely drove coverage in many of the important trials of our day, including the O.J. trial.
You know, I love the fact that his brother, John Gregory Dunn, the late husband of Joan Didion, you know, the high-minded Dunn, and then there was the sort of low Dunn, Dominic Dunn. In many ways, you know, it's kind of a Dunn dynasty there in Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, the thing is he pursued journalism as a kind of prosecution, and he was very, very aggressive and had an ability to sort of create intimacy with victims because his own daughter had been the victim of a crime. And people in various trials came to see him as an advocate, and he ended up with information that no one else had as a result.
His daughter, of course, that you mentioned there was murdered. You know, victim of a crime is a very celebrated
murder. Strangled to death, yes.
And she was a movie star in the movie Poltergeist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and it died tragically, and it altered his career. He quit drinking, became a writer, and became a writer like few others.
You know, I intersected with him very briefly in my own career as part of the enormous number of people who covered the O.J. affair back in the 90s. He was, for all of his personality and strangeness and eccentricity, a very sweet man.
He had an ability to pull you in, to get an arm on you, to whisper to you in a way that made you feel particularly validated and looked after, which was his gift as a journalist.
Charmer, journalist, entertainment icon himself, Dominic Dunn, dead in 83. That's David Carr talking about Dominic Dunn with us. Thank you, David.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Femi Okeh. You know, when you're healthy,
yes,
you feel like you've got choices, right?
Yeah, of course.
If you're chronically ill, though, in the healthcare debate, maybe you don't have much choice and have to pay for your healthcare on a day-to-day basis. We're going to talk with some chronically ill people as part of our healthcare roundtable in just a minute. And you've been hearing from people who do have options, the healthy, the young. Is it worth paying for healthcare insurance when you're young and healthy? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at thetakeaway.org. And here are some of the news stories we're following this morning. Senator Ted Kennedy's burial is set for Saturday, but first his family gathers for a private Cape Cod Mass today at noon. The next question for politicians in Massachusetts is who fills his Massachusetts Senate seat. Governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts says he supports changing state law so a successor can start work immediately, but he tells ABC News he's not going public on who might get the call yet.
We've got so much political talent in Massachusetts and have historically in that family and beyond. And I know there's a lot of interest in this seat.
Deval Patrick wants someone to serve in the seat temporarily until voters have their say in a special election.
Fresh numbers on the job market out this morning. New claims for unemployment benefits are down. 570,000 people applied for unemployment checks last week. And we have some more economic news due out next hour. The FDIC reveals how much money it spent covering failed banks. And there's some of the top stories we're watching today.
So we've talked with lots of people about healthcare in this healthcare debate. We've heard with young people. We've heard young people's stories about whether to get health insurance or not. We want to hear more from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Doctors have had interesting stories to tell regarding choices about treatment that are determined by insurance. Small businesses have to make tough choices. But you can't get more passionate about healthcare if you're one of the chronically ill. Our roundtable today concerns people who have chronic conditions that require maintenance on a day-to-day basis. Robert Groth joins us. He's an accountant from Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
And Sid Wiggum is a citizen in Lincoln, Nebraska. Sid, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you know, I'm a person who uses a wheelchair, and I resent, probably like you, being referred to as the guy in the wheelchair or the, you know, accountant with multiple sclerosis. But describe how your chronic condition affects your life. And you both have different conditions. And Robert Groth, first, why don't you begin?
Well, it affects my life in the fact that I've lost my sight to the point that I can't drive a car, so it's very difficult for me to get around.
And you have MS, is that right?
I have MS, yes.
Right, and how long have you had MS?
19 years.
Now, how does that complicate either the acquisition of insurance, the maintenance of your health care costs, and keeping yourself healthy?
Well, I've been fortunate enough to have insurance through my company. But it's a very small company, so it's a high deductible insurance, so it's been difficult from that standpoint that I constantly have to worry about if I'm no longer employed there, what do I do, and making sure that I have enough money to pay the deductibles and such because it's a high deductible insurance.
And anxiety bears fairly directly on your MS as well, correct?
Huge. As you said, I'm a tax preparer, and between January and April 15th, stress is a huge component of my life. And what's happened to me over the course of the last years is the stress has basically put me in the hospital each year, somewhere in the March range. And it's a huge issue.
We're not talking about because you're a complainer, you go into the hospital. It's actually one of the problems with MS is that its symptoms fluctuate on the basis of stress level, right?
Absolutely. What's happened, what's put me in the hospital is the fact that I couldn't walk. I was unable to, in one case, my sight again took a nosedive on me. So these are major issues where they have to try and jumpstart me back into health.
Sid Wiggum, how does your chronic condition there in Lincoln, Nebraska, complicate your day-to-day life, and how do you deal with health care?
It's been pretty bad because I lost my right leg, so I haven't been able to drive, even though I wear an amputee. But other than that, it's really just been bad because the wife and I have been together a long time, and things just aren't going good at all. We just filed bankruptcy. And other than that, my health care, I've been pretty lucky. I just had a bone marrow transplant. You know, it ended up costing $1 million.
And how are you insured?
Through Blue Cross, Blue Shield.
And does the fact that you have a chronic condition make your health maintenance easier or more difficult with Blue Cross?
Not too bad. You know, luckily that I have some kind of insurance. I feel for those that don't, you know, because I pay $160 a month just on medication alone.
So what is your total monthly outlay, do you think, for the coverage that you receive, Sid?
The total outlet?
How much you're spending per month?
Oh, just on the medication alone is $160. Like I said, things have gotten so bad, we just filed bankruptcy last month.
So even though you have a good program, good coverage, you still can't afford it, and it pushed you into bankruptcy. If you add up the medications plus the premium, it's too much.
Yes.
Robert, you are the founder of a website, conquerms.com. You have health insurance, but you must have heard from people visiting your website who don't. How do they even manage their illness without health insurance?
Well, what happens is you basically are forced to take the state plans. And even with the state plans, the insurance that you have is very, very expensive. So if you have any money or if you have any income that is coming in, if you aren't on full disability, you're forced to basically expend most of your income on trying to pay for the insurance to cover the drugs and the treatments. The drugs alone for me are $1,800 a month. So without insurance, that's a crushing expense that most people can't deal with.
Well, to both of you then, what do you need to hear in the healthcare debate to improve your situation? And are you hearing things that maybe are a little bit offensive or disturbing or hurtful? Like, for instance, I don't want to be paying for some poor person's healthcare. I want to only be paying for my own healthcare, which is a lot of what these town meetings have said. Sid, you first.
First, I think that it's a national travesty that the United States has as much money as that they have, and our healthcare is what it is. You figure we have a health care for profit, and we need a national health care plan for nonprofit. You know, our chief executive officers, they've made millions last year. They make more than our doctors and our nurses do who save lives, you know, and they're profiting off our sicknesses.
So as far as you're concerned, the takeaway really is reorienting medical or sort of economic equity so that the rich can subsidize people who aren't as well off for things like health care. That's really important to you, right, Sid?
Yes.
All right, Robert, how about you? What are you hearing or not hearing in the health care debate? And have you heard anything that's maybe been a little bit offensive?
Well, I think what I'm looking at is the fact that the way we receive treatment is really the thing that concerns me most. When we restructure and look at what is wrong with the system, just a little story is, you know, I've got a guy who I've met with in the alternative medicine area. We spent 2.5 days together going over what is the root cause of my illness, what is going on with my diet, my exercise, things of that nature. Came up with a true plan that was there for me to do. Contrast that with my last visit to my neurologist. And it lasted 12 minutes where we said, okay, here is get this thing for vitamin D, a test on that, do this other test here for another blood test, and let's have you get another MRI, which is another $1,800 out of my pocket, and we'll see you maybe again in 6 months. So the care level, I think, is just a matter of we're churning people through the system. We aren't really getting to the root cause of what's wrong with people suffering from diseases, and we're really leaving people out in the cold, in my opinion, in the way the system's working.
Robert Groth and Sig Wiggum, it would be good to watch you and others like you as this debate unfolds, that's for sure. Robert Groth is an accountant with multiple sclerosis, and Sid Wiggum is a diabetic amputee and cancer survivor. Two people chronically ill. Thanks so much to both of you.
You know, my takeaway from their conversation was that healthcare isn't just about me and what I need. It's about the whole community. So Robert and Sid's needs are just as important as mine.
Well, investing strategically is one issue, and then dealing with a medical calamity that is part of your reality. It's an important debate.
Now, tomorrow, we're going to be hearing from Americans who've used other countries' healthcare systems. How do they compare? And we also want you to be part of the conversation.
So you're going to
well.
Be on the show, right?
Yeah, maybe. That's a cheap booking. 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us your healthcare story. My name is Femi Ok.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This, of course, is, and as you said last hour, be well, everyone. The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.